Yep.
Yep.
Welcome to the Age of Vision radio show with your host, Lonnie Clark. We stand together and accept that we now live in a world transformed by Fukushima. From 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, here on UCY.TV radio, we relentlessly engage every ear that listens. We expose and confront the complete lack of accountability for the nuclear industry. Consider social engineering programs who view our bodies, minds, and souls as assets on a balance sheet. We discuss vital current issues, interview activists, and engage our audience in an effort to allow all voices to be heard. The Age of Vision radio show creates a venue that all will choose. We encourage our listeners to reclaim their power and their courage to take action and save our planet from the ravages of greed and indifference. Our actions matter. Every voice matters. We remind our listeners that happiness is resistance. Love is greater than fear.
Good morning, UCY.TV radio listeners. This is Lonnie Clark with the Age of Vision radio show. Thank you for joining us. Today is April 13th, 2018. It's 8 o'clock in the morning. I guess that means it's Friday 13th, you guys, so we get to watch out for that black witch, I guess. The black cat and the witch. Not the black witch, but the black cat and the witch. How about that? I don't know about the Friday the 13th thing, but...
I like witches.
I like witches, too. My niece actually told me I was a natural witch. So I want to introduce to you our guest and also my co-host, Jerome Hebert, the Sane Environmentalist on YouTube. Hi, Jerome.
Good morning, everybody.
Jerome actually helped save me. I was on 5 days a week, and I called him up and asked to share the show with me, and it's been really helped me get my health back, to be honest. So thanks, Jerome. Thanks for helping me become sane again. And you know, John Abbey is, I met John Abbey through KEPW. He is on the board there, and he has been an activist for a long time. We had a very dear mutual friend that passed away several years ago. That's how I first heard about him, and I only met him recently. So thank you, John, for joining us. I really appreciate you taking the time. I hope you'll come back and join us again.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I just want to clear one thing up. I'm actually not on the board at KEPW.
Oh, I thought you were. Okay.
No, I'm the communications coordinator and do some other things. But have a show, Life Water is Life, with Janet Thrift on Friday nights from 6 to 7 p.m.
Which I've played. I played her interview with Louisa Hamacek on the show a few weeks ago. It was awesome.
Nice. Thank you.
I really love the work that you guys do at KEPW. I mean, honestly, it's awesome. What is that organization that you were also involved in? This is a funny name.
Get into the funny. It's very serious to me, actually. It's the International Association for the Advancement of Creative Maladjustment. And the person who introduced me to it is David Oakes, who was the founder and longtime director at the Mind Freedom International, which is based in the same building that KEPW is, Growers Market in downtown Eugene. And the history of it is this. It actually is something that Martin Luther King repeatedly called for the creation of. In his speeches, he would acknowledge, you know, that as a minister, he'd run into, you know, a lot of people who were in the psychological, you know, terminology at the time, you know, maladjusted, who he acknowledged, you know, they needed help. They were struggling and they needed help to become more adjusted to society. But King would go on to say, you know, there are some things to which I refuse to become adjusted. I refuse to be adjusted to racial injustice. I refuse to become adjusted to poverty, and you know, list these things that we are all still struggling, you know, to fully resolve or more fully resolve, and or in some cases address at all. But he would go on to say that these are things to which I want to be creatively maladjusted. And in fact, we need many people who are creatively maladjusted to these ills of our society. And that what we really need, he said, is for someone to start an international association for the advancement of creative maladjustment. Now, David Oakes.
I think I found my home here.
Yeah, right?
So this is mindfreedom.org. Is that that's the website?
That, if people want to go online, and I can send you a link. I don't know if you have a way to send it to your listeners. I can send you a link directly to the page where that quotes from a number of Martin Luther King speeches, Martin Luther King Jr. speeches, where he talks about it. But if you search Mind Freedom, IAACM King, I believe you will find it.
Yeah. On the very first page, it talks about it. There's a right when you go to the home page, it says fulfilling Martin Luther's vision.
Right, and that may or may not get you directly to the quotes, but they're there somewhere.
Okay. Well, Well, definitely send me the link, because we can ask Jules, our producer, to put it in the information section, because we do post up on YouTube, you know, pretty quickly after the show, so people could actually find it. So,
great.
That's, you know, the reason I asked you on, we were having this conversation about that I'm kind of sick of the facts of, you know, Jerome's really kind of Mr. Science guy. In fact, yesterday's show was really good. About the science stuff. And he explains, he has a way of explaining what happens, if I don't say so myself, of what happens with the nuclear process, what happens when all this happens and how it affects us. And in ways that people like me who can't seriously after 5 years still grasp the science of it, I kind of get it, but I don't really understand the bigger picture because I don't think like that. So this, and I'm just... You know, to me, having more studies that nuclear is bad, that, you know, like the Uranium Festival sent me out a tweet, invited me to go to the Uranium Festival in November through December, and I think it's going to be in Santa Fe. I honestly couldn't understand what they were saying, so I asked him to say, where is this exactly? If you go to the website, uraniumfestival.org, I think that's it, you'll see. I couldn't tell where it's at, but it's at a place called the Big Window. I think it's Big Windows, Arizona, which is makes sense because Arizona is completely contaminated with uranium. So, but they're saying we need more studies that uranium causes harm. We don't need more studies. We need more. We need more addressing. We need more science going into stopping this stuff from, you know, entering our groundwater and removing it from our groundwater, because we're already there with, you know, Fukushima is going to dump, 777,000 tons of treated water into the Pacific Ocean all at once. Boom, they're going to do it. They just announced that all those tanks of water, they're going in the ocean, baby.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that gets a response.
When did they announce that?
I just saw it yesterday. 777,000 tons of water from Fukushima is going. They have let us know it's happening. And this is the thing. That's a lot of water. And honestly, I think maybe they've already been putting a lot more in that they haven't been telling us. I think that's the other thing that I think we need to stop with the, oh, we need more testing, too. We need more truth, you know?
Yeah, you'll never get that out of the Japanese government, though.
Nor the American.
Yeah.
I'm seeing the article in Newsweek. Sorry, go ahead.
We've been consistently lied to by our government regarding nuclear, period. Everything about it. And
I think it's beyond
no reason for the world to believe that'll change.
like that, the organization Beyond Nuclear. It's actually Beyond Nuclear because it's all the technologists. This is the thing. We have a culture of lying. And frankly, this is why I really like this organization that you have joined here, John. And actually, I think I might ought to have to join that.
Anybody can. Anybody can be a leader. Nobody's going to sue anybody, you know, but I think that really the only... The thing that David Oakes and I hope that anybody who uses the name, you know, we don't feel a big sense of ownership in it, but we certainly hope that everybody who uses the name will stay in line with Martin Luther King's views on nonviolence, which, of course, does not mean sit passively and let stuff happen. King exactly. caused a whole lot of trouble, which a lot of people were very upset about at the exactly. time. And if he were active today, people would say, why can't you be nice and quiet like Martin Luther King was, Jr. was? And of course, that was not what he was. He was very loud, but in a nonviolent, principled way.
He also had a lot of courage.
Not just loud. He was disruptive. It was very disruptive of society.
Right.
In order to get some action, because that's what was needed.
That's right. And that is what's needed now. And still, that's why, you know, I tell people, put your courage feet on. And by that, I mean, like, it is not easy to take action against what you know you're walking into. You're going to get some pushback. It's not an easy task to stand and have courage and do the right thing in the face. We have a formidable adversary in front of us who has had power and control for at least 100 years. It's been a long time coming. You know, the American people have been kind of sidewinded. You know, we've gotten hit on the back of the head since Trump's been elected. Like, we're waking up going, wait a minute, this is what we've turned into. And I agree with you, because this is the thing. I'm super big on names and name calling. It is so important not to dig in, not to allow the name calling and the hostility and the anger to perpetrate our thoughts and our hearts. Like, we really must constantly remember our humanity in the face of these people pushing us to be just like them. They want us to be just like them.
To me, the adversary is not any particular person or group of people, although there are people and groups of people who I think, you know, need to be removed from roles where they can cause a lot of trouble. To me, the primary adversary is, or really I would say challenge, is as human beings, like, our brains give us this incredible power to imagine things that don't exist and often bring them into existence. And that both creates, you know, incredible positive possibilities and incredible negative possibilities. And I just think we're in a thousands of years, you know, at least long process of figuring out if our consciousness, if we're going to be able to learn how to harness it and apply it with wisdom and so on in a way that ultimately is in sync, you know, with the rest of the natural world, and then it'll go well for the rest of the natural world and us, or it won't. You know, we won't find a way to fit in and go forward in a positive way, and, you know, then we're going to continue to cause a lot of trouble for other species and for ourselves, you know, maybe to the point of extinction. But that's our challenge. Can we come to right relationship with our own consciousness and each other and the rest of the natural world?
At our current, I don't think at our current population density we can. Not if
right.
we continue to use energy in the way that we use energy. Now,
sure.
if we become smarter and more wise about our energy usage and use our energy as a precious, precious commodity, and try to not use it as much as we can versus just use it for whatever is convenient, I think that's another thing, unless it's energy derived from the sun or some other natural form.
And even in that case, it's just the more power you throw around, the greater risks you're playing with. And if your level of wisdom isn't up to handling that level of power, even if there's no costs in some systemic sense, in some physics sense of using the power, there can still be there's still hazards in having a lot of it around, especially if it's concentrated in particular places.
Yeah, and Einstein once said that humanity's biggest problem is that its technology has outgrown its wisdom.
Right.
And I think he had it right on the money there.
And I would say even our even our language technology has kind of outstripped our wisdom. And, you know, and that's what we're trying to figure out, if we can become wise enough to handle our intelligence wisely.
Oh my God, Lonnie, I'm so sorry to interrupt, guys, but the barrel that blew up.
Yeah.
Guess where the mixture that was in it came from?
Yeah,
Rocky Flats.
I know. That's what I said. It came from Rocky Flats. It came from Idaho. I know. Oh, yeah, yeah. The one in Idaho, I knew that. I remember reading that. It did come from Rocky Flats. He just did a whole series on Rocky Flats this week that was awesome.
Oh, great. Perfect context.
Yeah.
The story is that the barrel was in containment in Idaho, in storage.
That's right.
Okay, and so I'm going to... It came from Rocky Flats. So it's plutonium waste.
That's right. And if you look at it, they said, oh, don't worry, nothing happened. It was in a safe place, and everybody was perfectly okay. So no harm. A few of the workers got the contamination on their skin, but, you know, it doesn't go through your skin, so don't worry about it. That's the implication. If you read the story, it said a few workers got it on their skin, but they're fine.
Yeah, seriously. Plutonium doesn't go through your skin.
Yeah, so that's why that comment was in that article. So
now that's going to be
This is the subtlety of how they're saying it. That's why it's okay, because it just went on their skin. But that again is also a lie. There's no safe exposure. Those people are going to get very sick. That is not true. You cannot just have that stuff fall on your skin and be okay. Hello. There's a ton more chemicals that are in there that actually cause a lot of things. It's not the radioactivity. It's all the other chemicals. That's the point about it. It's not just the radioactivity. It's all of it. The lying, the complete lying and absolute disregard for responsibility or human health. Honestly, this is why Trump is in the White House, because this has been our motto for 80 years. He is the pinnacle of what America has been about. A big bully, mafioso, we're going to do what we want, disregard the law. We have money. We can buy our way out of anything. Don't dare cross us, because we'll get you murdered.
I certainly hope he's the pinnacle. I remember hoping that Reagan was the pinnacle and that Bush was the pinnacle. And frankly, in some ways, you know, hoping that Clinton was the pinnacle and that Obama was the pinnacle, because there are plenty of ways that the Democrats, you know, go along with some of the main root problems that we have, even if some of us might think they're better on a lot of things, which I do. But I think there are deeper issues that both parties, you know, are not really oriented fully, at least, to address. And yeah, I'm wondering if we could just zoom in a little bit talking about the toxin stuff before we dig further into the social side, because that's you referenced the conversation we had. It was last week, last Saturday at Saturday Market here in downtown Eugene. And and like you just said something like there's no safe amount. And I mean, I know, you know, that you know, and I'm sure Jerome knows that there is a background radiation that we're all exposed to and other toxic, you know, stuff that we're exposed to that just exist in the natural world. A lot of plants and animals produce toxins. Our own bodies produce toxins. There's radiation from space. There's radiation from radioactive materials in the crust of the earth, you know, some of which come up to the surface naturally. So there's a background level of radiation which systemically, you know, has helped to provoke evolution.
John Goffman said does cause some portions of cancer, to be clear.
Absolutely. There has been a background level of cancer since long before humans started digging
things up. But not that much. And this is the point.
Exactly.
And it is a man-made, we do not need to add to the mix. It is highly toxic. And in fact, it is accumulative, because even the background radiation, it accumulates. Right. And so the reason that we didn't have high levels is it was really accumulative depending on where you lived. And that is, I mean, honestly, this is really insane, beyond comprehension. What has happened to our planet, what the technologists have done, these power-hungry people who just want power and power.
That's where in our conversation the other day, we were talking about the accumulation, and I brought up the natural step.
Well, yes, there is natural stuff. And that's, in fact, the argument of the pro-nukers. Well, there's natural stuff everywhere. It's kind of
No, that's not what I meant. The natural step, the group I was talking about in Sweden.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Natural step.
Yeah. Should I say a little bit more about that?
Please do. I'll pull up the website and I'll let you, since you know about it, I'm not going to try to repeat your words.
I'm often terrible with names, so I'm forgetting name of the main... Oh, here we go. Carl Henrik Robert. So this was a scientist in Sweden who got into an iterative process. He asked a bunch of scientists, look, when we talk about sustainability, we talk about so many things. How can we get it, down to something very simple? And he asked them each to just try to describe at a core level, what are the systemic conditions that would allow us to be sustainable? And whatever they wrote, he digested all of it from all of them, and then he summarized it, sent it back to them, and then they responded to that, and so on. And they ended up with three system conditions that would be required in order to be physically sustainable long term. And I'm not going to read them, I'm going to paraphrase them, and we can put those links on your podcast site as well. But it's pretty simple. It's one: stop digging toxic stuff out of the Earth's crust and spreading it all over the planet. Two, stop synthesizing new toxic stuff and spreading that all over the planet. Three, stop just directly physically degrading the ecosystems, species extinction, straightening out rivers, so on. If you continue to do that a lot, you degrade, life's resilience and biodiversity and so on. And then they realized, after they'd kind of put these out and been talking with people for a while, these are scientists, probably pretty well off, and they realized eventually, pretty quickly, we really need to add a fourth, social system condition, which pretty much amounts to make sure that there's enough equity that there aren't a whole bunch of people who are so poor that out of desperation they're driven to violate, the first three things just to stay alive. So, poor people in a lot of areas, if they're near a forest, they'll go and chop down trees to stay warm, even if they know they're hurting their long-term sustainability, even if they can see that, because they need to stay alive through a winter. And so when we allow non-equitable systems to be the dominant way that our societies are organized, we guarantee that there are a bunch of people who, even if they know better, are going to do these things that will lead to us being unsustainable. So that we have to have that fourth system condition that society is fair enough that people aren't driven to those extremes.
Okay, so now, but the issue now is not that. Number four is how to implement it now that the people that are out of whack are in control and have really already perpetrated a lot of the ecological harm and are continuing to do so at rapid pace right now, I might say.
Well, I think it's an illusion for us to give in to the idea that they're in charge. We outnumber them vastly, and history is full of examples where when enough of us realize that and come together, it becomes obvious that actually we have the power.
Well, that's that. Then you get into the question of, are you willing to risk a nuclear war? Because these people will actually take out a few cities. They will subject people to whatever they need to do to get you to sit down and shut up. If you don't believe that, then, you'll find out. Because we had 5 million people in the street. Has Congress done jack about the criminal in the White House? No. In fact, yesterday, Mitch McConnell blocked the bill that would protect the Mueller investigation from even getting a vote at the Senate.
So are you saying it's hopeless?
No, I'm just saying that it has to eat its own arms off. I think there is a level of accountability, but you know what? At this point, we have to be more clever than... because we're already on, it's like being battered children. It's not even like being a battered wife where you can go to a battered wife shelter. There is really no battered country shelter. There's no, we have to dig out from within. And it's almost like when you're a kid coming from a very severely dysfunctional, violent childhood, it's a matter of just surviving until you can get out, because they eventually collapse in on themselves.
Right, but we have nowhere to get out to. So I agree with you completely that we have to be incredibly creative. And we've seen over time how some of the strategies that we take that might have some success, you know, at one time, over time, the powers that be find ways to blunt and co-opt those strategies. So I think we have to be continuously creative to make progress.
Honestly, that's why I say happiness is resistance. I've said that for a long time. Because you know what? They want us to be miserable because miserable people are easy to control.
Mm-hmm.
We don't, if you're happy and you're relentless, like whatever, you can do whatever. That's a strategy I learned. I mean, I'm a survivor of child abuse. Mm-hmm. So this, and I actually was thinking about this the other night. Like those of us, I would wonder how many people who survived child abuse are activists in their adult lives? I venture a large portion of them because they learned how to weave through the system and not give up. Because it's not like in the, I mean, it's been how long in the anti-nuclear movement? I feel sorry for these anti-nuclear people who are my age who were intelligent and educated enough. I wouldn't say intelligent, but I had no idea. I remember Helen Caldicott as a younger woman and loved her, listened to her on the radio all the time, thought that she actually stopped nuclear. I thought they really did do it. I thought that million people in the street had worked and that I really did not understand the gravity of the nuclear contamination until I started doing this radio show and interviewing people and talking to people in different communities and paying attention and like, wow. And Heidi Lambert, who grew up right in Richland, you know, and says, you know what, when we look at the hard reality, there, when you look at the plutonium they bombed us with on the planet, we have so much stuff in our food supply, in our water. We need to just get a grip and admit it and stop denying it doesn't cause harm to human health. And just adjust and say, welcome to the age of fission, baby, because you're in it.
Welcome to the age of acceptable risk.
Mm-hmm. Eat right, be happy.
Organic food.
And you know, love is greater than fear. You know what, John? This is what I think. We need a love movement.
Absolutely. One of my the books I always remember going back to kind of early in my evolution of understanding what's going on and where we can go that will be helpful was Leo Biscaglia's book Love. And watching some of his videos on television back, you know, before the internet was widely spread or did video.
So we do need to deep dive the love. I mean, and that's the only thing that we can do. And this is the thing, though. This is why they pour so much money out on Fox News, though, to spew hate, because they know love is greater than fear. So they spend billions to convince all the undereducated and the weak, you know, and the elderly.
And even the well-educated.
People that just sit there.
I've seen older people get sucked into that.
Exactly. Yep. They just drink. John Bolton's not a bad guy, you know. He's doing what we need to do. And I'm like, dude, really?
They're scared. They're scared of us being in love with ourselves, with each other. They're really scared when we approach them, you know, and are still able to see their humanity. That scares the bejesus out of them, most of them, because most of the people in positions of power are also traumatized by our society, and they're acting out of that trauma. And they are terrified to face what is going on in them. And so when they see somebody approaching who isn't even yelling at them, but who's like has eyes of understanding and might really listen to them and let them, you know, let out what's really going on and inside. Oh, my goodness. I mean, I've been in that place. You know, I have plenty of that trauma in me. And there are times when I'm so impacted about it, I'm terrified to face what's going on in me because I'm afraid that all I'll get, you know, is judgment from the other person or from myself. And so I don't want to face it, you know, but I know that if I can get over that hump, you know, that in reality, mostly people will listen to I've seen it so many times, you know, people sharing a story about something they've done that they're embarrassed about or that really was awful in some way. But if they share it and they're vulnerable about it and what drove them to it, other people are understanding. And it doesn't mean forgiving it right away or saying it's okay you did that. It just means, wow, that sucks that you were in that position and that you made that choice, but I can still see your humanity You know, I can see how, that's what, if we start to all see each other's humanity and forgive each other for the little ways, you know, we're hurting each other, or just understand each other for why the little ways we're hurting each other, we won't be subject to divide and conquer anymore. And we will be present a strong front and come up and change the situation. So that it terrifies them both, to the idea of losing power if we come together that way. And I think it also often terrifies them personally. I had a little of this interaction at Standing Rock at the very end, after the largest removal of people at Chatishakoan and Rosebud camps were removed. There was a kind of a new border between Sacred Stone Camp and the areas that they had cleared out. And the BIA was there, the kind of the tribal reservation police force. So I knew they were, you know, probably kind of on our side in some ways. And I went and talked with them at that border, you know, and they said, of course, we couldn't go back into Rosebud Camp where they'd cleared us out from. And I said, I'm sad, you know, that you're in a position where you're here to stop us from trying to protect the water. And, you know, I could see in their eyes how it affected them to be vulnerable about that with them. It wasn't an accusing. It wasn't an accusing thing.
Well, that's that. In a way, I get you on that one, because that's kind of how I feel about the workers that work in the nuclear industry, because they spout the party line that don't worry, it doesn't harm you. I think I really make an effort to understand that they have a lot of compassion, that they really understand science, that they see this as their duty, that they're helping humanity. But what I don't appreciate, and this is why it's really important for me to continue to see their humanity, is that they're going along with the nuclear lies, even when their own friends, their own family members have birth defects, get sick, die early. They're just all in denial because it's so terrifying, the negative effects.
If they acknowledge it, what would they do? Their whole life comes into question.
Well, the problem, not just their whole life. You know what happens is, like my guest, Erica Dugan, who is acknowledging the harm that fracking has done to her. Her medical benefits have been threatened. Her doctors basically said, you want that treatment, go to the next state. I mean, it has been gotten really bad for her. And she comes on my show on a regular basis, and people can check out those podcasts. Her name is Erica Dugan. She contacted me sometime last year and said, hey, I've got something to talk about, because really, this is outrageous. And I'm like, please do. You know, I normally just talk about nuclear contamination, but I really do think it's part of it all, because it's not just nuclear. It's the whole, it's a cultural thing.
It's right. There's physical toxins, and then there's also social toxins. When we're, butt heads to each other, we're putting, you know, a little social toxin in it. I have to say it weakly that way. It would sound more, it would be conveyed if I could use the proper word. But
the F word, the word we're not allowed to talk about. But, you know, the thing is, this is really, I'm kind of glad that that language thing is in there, because it really does help us to stay and walk in love and remember that we need to be mindful of each other. And that's the thing. That's what that law is about more than anything, is just be mindful of each other. Because right now there's complete disregard for people's feelings, for their lives. Like, I mean, and for the facts, the truth, they're just making stuff up as they go along. And it just depends on which side you're listening to. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I would say, you know, the antidote, you know, to the social toxins are exactly some of the things we've been talking about. To be honest with ourselves and each other, love, vulnerability,
honesty. Like, just allow yourself to be wrong sometimes, and allow yourself to say, to, you know, be hurt by, sometimes even our own actions hurt us. But that's okay. I mean, it's about life. We have a short period of time, and it's apparently becoming much shorter because of the technologists have basically contaminated our planet to a point where at least this generation, if any humanity survives, this generation is going to have a short-lived life, because you know, these nuclear contaminated sites, that sludge, you think that's the, how many, Jerome, how many more do you think like that could potentially happen?
I was just reading.
I bet.
The guy said that because the secretive record keeping during the Cold War makes it difficult for officials to know what's in the barrels, they don't really know. It could blow up. It could not blow up. There could be enough plutonium in any single barrel to have a criticality event if you get a fire and add water. Plutonium is nasty, and that's what this stuff is. If it's from Rocky Flats, it's plutonium. It's the milling and cutting fluids that they use that were too contaminated to use anymore for cutting and milling.
Oh my God.
And they've been sitting there since 1950. You know, so there's all kinds of chemical and other changes that occur, processes that continue on, and the barrels are thermally active, i.e. they're hot, because plutonium is hot. You know, they release enough plutonium to create what they call thermally active areas in the nearby reservoirs, where you could actually take a thermal image of the reservoir, and you could see right where the plutonium was because the water was warmer. That's how much. So yeah, it's not looking good. It's not looking good, and Rocky Flats needs to come right to the forefront, including all of the sludge and waste and other stuff that is still out there, and just as nasty as the day it was created. So.
Well, I'm glad you brought up about all the toxic mix, you know, in the barrels or whatever of nuclear waste. That was something that when I first learned about that, I think I was kind of like you in a way, Lonnie. When I was younger, I kind of assumed that this nuclear stuff would be all, you know, the waste would be, you know, organized, and they knew where it was and how much and so on. And when I learned that there were large quantities of it that were just mixed up this and that, they don't know exactly what's in there and how many different toxic substances are involved, it gets scary. And so I'm curious, you know, I mean, they've been wanting for a long time to find one place they can dump it all, a giant sacrifice zone. And I know some people, you know, who are concerned about nuclear, you know, may think that's a good idea. I don't know. It's a problem with no really good solution. But I'm wondering, Jerome, because of your, you know, research and background on this, if you or Lonnie, you know, have heard or have your own ideas about what do we do with it all? What is the safest thing?
Well, the safest thing, I think, is to stop moving it around, number one, because you spill a little every time. So wherever it is, unless it's right next to a big body of water, build a containment and build a 10,000-year containment and have a plan for the containment to be renewable and restructurable so that it can last, because it will take, for this barrel of waste, it will take no less than 300,000-400,000 years.
But Jerome, that's with current science. To be honest, I recently read that a few scientists have come up with a way to reverse this, to reverse the nuclear chain, so to speak. I'm going to put it, see, this is why I'm not good at explaining this, because
that's the kind of science that depends on the stuff being all sorted out. If it's the stuff all mixed together, my understanding is they don't have yet a good way to do it.
But I think what they're doing, and also let's just don't forget the phytoremediation. Phytoremediation is a magnificent thing that can actually really work. I mean, they know that the hemp plants, they know the Knief plants super absorb the radioactive contaminations. They know mushrooms super absorb radioactive contamination.
I'm missing one word there. What remediation?
The hemp, the phytoremediation.
Phyto? Oh, P-H-Y-T-O. Phyto. Aha. So there's something about the chemistry of some plants.
There's certain plants that just like zzz. Now, you still have it in these plants and you still have to figure out what to do with it. But there is steps that we can take. But this is the issue. It's not just even the radioactive contamination. It's the plastics. It's the oil industry. It's the coal. It's the whole shebang of it all. The uranium mining that is nonstop, like they are going gangbangers on the uranium mining.
And I hear you pointing to the likely prospect that with science there already is all this promising stuff, and I'm hearing that you are actually hopeful that scientifically we will be able to shorten the time that we have to have this stuff around and deal with it.
Yes. I mean, actually, I don't know. Do you follow, John, do you know who Guy McPherson is?
Yes.
Guy put out a video this week on YouTube that says we've got like 2 years left.
Didn't he say that 5 years ago?
No, he's saying because this is going to be the first year that we have water on the Arctic without no snow on the Arctic during the summer. That's what they're projecting.
He thinks this summer, right. I've heard a lot of predictions, and I try not to hold my breath because it may or may not be this year, but I do know that the consensus is that it's going to be very soon now,
Mm-hmm. But the point is this, even if that happens, see, I don't give up on humanity surviving. I think a lot of people are going to go to the wayside. I think we're going to meet our maker a lot faster than what we would have thought. But you know what? That's how it is anyways. We all die.
the longer we wait to start getting serious about getting into right relationship with the rest of the natural world and ourselves and each other, which has to be part of it, the longer we wait, the more painful the transition is going to be. You know, so I was very disappointed when Ronald Reagan took down the solar water heating panels that Jimmy Carter had installed on the White House roof. And it just as a symbol that we were going to start making that transition. And Carter was the last president who made a significant increase in funding for environmental things. Yeah,
I know. And actually, this has been the biggest harm. When people say, oh, there's no difference between Clinton and Trump, yes, there is. Clinton would not have gone after the environment and the EPA regulations the way that Trump has. This would not have happened. I don't care whatever else you might have done. This is the big, I think this is such a sad thing. This is the hardest part about it, is his supporters just completely deny that these regulations have actually helped, force people to be accountable.
There's an article in the New York Times today that 80% of the tax cuts are going to foreign people from other countries.
That's right.
And at first you have to be, how could that be true? Well, they were geared, these tax cuts, to give the huge majority of the tax cuts go to very wealthy people doing business in America. Well, the oligarchy is global. The U.S. is still in some ways the single superpower, but there are plenty of oligarchs, in other countries whose economics are all tied up. Some are and some aren't, but some of them have their economics all tied up here. They own businesses here and so on. So they benefited. It should be no surprise, thinking about it, that the benefits of that tax cut for the wealthy went to people all over the world.
So again, the government took our baby.
and while getting many of us to thank them for it, they throw some crumbs to poor people in the middle class. Actually, some people, it even hurt directly. But, it's like, here, you get a few $100s. You should feel really good that you have a few $100 tax cut.
See, this is their argument.
While wealthy people are getting, millions reduced.
Their argument is the same. It's like, well, we just have to it's like they feel as if the so-called entitlements that they want to cut or have been like our, what do they call, our allowance. Like they're just cutting our allowance and forcing us to work for ourselves.
But we're so lucky that they're willing to give some of, our tax money back to us.
Well, this is the issue. When we look at the fact that there's all of this going to foreign to foreign investors. When our main news networks like Fox, who spouts out massive propaganda, really is owned by a Saudi crown prince and by a person who is not an American citizen, Murdoch. I mean, it's so obvious that we have really lost our way in terms. The only way back is for us to decide we're going to be happy. We're going to take our life back. We're going to say that love is greater than fear. And frankly, stand up for our democracy, because democracy hangs on a thread. It does matter. And yes, the government is not working, but it neither are the citizens who don't vote.
Well, some of them are. I mean, I kind of wish, more people would pursue all strategies, but I try to work with everybody where they are. If somebody is they think electoral politics is stupid, but they're investing all their energy in building good relationships and building good local networks and so on, and doing good things, building gardens, teaching people how to live better, that's a positive. And then
A positive, but I will tell you what, it really falls short in a democracy that is hanging on a thread, because when the military police come rolling down the street saying, hey, you can't build that organic garden right here, and if you do, we're going to come in and shred it apart. What do you think Standing Rock is about?
I agree.
That's
it's not enough
step
by
towards
itself.
Militarism.
I agree. It's the fourth or tenth step towards it. We're in the police have been militarized. I remember here during Occupy Eugene, there was a demonstration in front of a bank, Bank of America, and they got really nervous at the bank, and they called the police, and they made it sound much worse than it was. And the police, rather than coming and really checking it out first, there was a liaison set up, a police liaison and an Occupy Eugene liaison. And before, checking that out and getting, that person-to-person to connection to find out what was really going on, the police responded urgently, which, they have to be ready if they get something, if it is true. But they came and were all gearing up in SWAT gear and so on. And really, it was a pretty harmless demonstration. So, yeah, the police are already geared up to be super militarized. So I agree with you completely that if all we do is build alternative institutions and develop our ability to take care of ourselves, that alone may not be enough. So and then in the same way on the other side, I think there's some people who say, oh, we shouldn't waste time doing healing stuff and building gardens and making social circles. We just need to focus 100% on the nuts and bolts of electing people and so on. I support them if they're trying to get good people elected. But my greatest joy is working with people who believe that all those things are helpful and more, and support and connect all these efforts with each other, because I think they can be incredibly supportive of each other.
Indeed, and they need to be. And the thing is, this is where we get to appreciate each other, because really, you can't do everything. So you have to focus on one thing, like what is it that you're going to really talk about and get engaged in. I mean, that's kind of been my little lesson, because and appreciate and reach out and network with other people whose thing is doing something else. Like, because it's like the political sphere where, like a friend of mine, Jerie, she's involved with the Democratic Party. I'm like, how can you stand those people? She's like, you know what? Because the alternative is allowing this to happen. What's happened? But, I think it's to me, it's kind of deeper. I honestly, at this point, can't stand the Democrats either. I see them exactly as I think we've had a silent military coup. I think we're living under Pinochet 2.0. The CIA did a perfect job of installing. They didn't have a fake military coup. They had a fake election and installed the perfect guy. And the Congress, how Pinochet succeeded? Because he had a parliament that went along with them and didn't stand up for their new budding democracy and constitution. And we have a Congress doing exactly the same thing, which is why Mitch McConnell suppressed the bill that would protect the Mueller investigation. And the very next morning, what does Donald Trump say? Oh, I'm pardoning Scooter Libby. Hint, hint, anybody who's going to talk to Mueller? That's obstruction of justice in its own. That alone should get some type of a hearing going.
Well, as it, I think you're pointing in part at like the at kind of the beauty of how some self-correction happens. I think even if you're not a revolutionary, it's pretty clear we're in the late stages of a gilded age. The oligarchs are kind of nakedly in power. People like Jimmy Carter and Bill Moyers over the last few years have acknowledged publicly and ranted a bit publicly about the United States now really being more of an oligarchy than a democracy. There are studies, you know, showing that government decisions are far more influenced, you know, by people with money and so on than the general public. Like, they've studied what happens legislatively versus public opinion versus opinion of, you know, wealthy people. Not that they all have the same opinion, but and they've become so detached, most of them, from day to day, from other people's 99% experience, that they, even when they wish, even when they would like to be doing good PR, they don't know how to do it well enough. Like, Trump knows how to do it well enough to fool, you know, 30% of the people, but he you know, that won't win elections ultimately.
April 10th.
He snuck through for a lot of reasons last time, but April 10th, what?
April 10, 2012, Scientific America wrote a story, "How Wealth Reduces Compassion as Riches Grow Empathy for Others Seems to Decline." So that's where they're at.
Right.
That's the issue, and, 100%.
And the beauty of humanity is that a few people are able to resist that to some degree, or whether or not they keep compassion, like some of them manage to stay aware that if they want to stay, keep their wealth, they at least need to throw a bone, you know. So you have people like Warren Buffett acknowledging that there has been a class war going on for a long time and that his side has won, and, you know, telling his fellow wealthy people, hey, we need to at least, you know, give the people enough so they don't rise up against us. But this is what I'm saying. Most of the wealthy class, the 1%, are so detached, so alienated from other people's experience, even if they want to throw us a bone, they kind of don't know how to do it. You know, they say things that show how out of touch they are, even when they're trying to throw us a bone.
Yeah. Yeah, that's actually very true. So let's go back to this thing, what's it called? The mindfreedom.org, right? That's kind of a catchier name. And that is the campaign. To say the name again, because that's kind of a tongue twister.
Mind Freedom International. So this is a one of the early human rights and mental health organizations that David Oakes founded here in Eugene, Oregon, after his personal experience being in the mental health system and experiencing a lot of coercion, you know, coercion.
Hence,
to
creative maladjustment, because he was labeled maladjusted.
That's the relationship ultimately, but I don't know. I don't know when he, you know, heard and found about Martin Luther King's speeches on creative maladjustment. But he founded the organization because of his experience, you know, having forced, I don't remember exactly whether he had forced medication or I don't think he had forced electroshock, but that still happens. That shocked me.
Right.
When I was hired there to discover that in the 2010s in United States of America, people were still being coerced into electroshock therapy. And, you know, I kind of knew that drugging was really pushed on people. If you really start to dig into it and read about it, if you're not familiar with it personally, you know, even if the percentage of cases in which people are, you know, very directly physically forced, have these things forced on them, there's a ton more people who are essentially socially coerced into doing these things, you know, by their psychiatrist or their family.
Yeah.
And they need help and support. And we need to change, you know, the whole psychiatric way of thinking. There's going to be a demonstration in this from this network. There's a lot of other groups, you know, and individuals involved in the country and worldwide. And they're going to be demonstrating at the American Psychiatric Association's annual gathering, which is in New York this June or July. So this is an issue with a lot of dimensions, both to help individuals who've been affected and to try and change the overall, you know, ways of thinking of professionals and laws and so on. So this is one of the weird edges around gun control, right? Because often you hear this thing of, oh, we shouldn't ban guns. We should just ban crazy people from having guns. And that's, you know, some people are, well, don't take away our gun rights. But you know, that's a slippery slope to start doing it for crazy people. But more importantly, for those of us who are focused not on guns, when we think about the part where we're focused on human rights and mental health, it further stigmatizes, you know, people. Most of them are not actually a risk. Most of us, I should say, I've had issues. And we don't want to start down that, you know, that slippery slope. We're already a ways down. We have certainly no need to deepen it. So to me, the mental health angle isn't, you know, ban guns, ban crazy people from having guns. The mental health angle is exactly the stuff that we've been talking about, the toxic social scene, you know, and I've seen kids talking about this in the guns in schools conversation. Some of them get up and say, you know, the gun thing, okay, but also look at how we treat each other. Can we find ways to treat each other so that we don't create social pariahs who go out and do these things?
Exactly.
And it's not enough to just have to say that to the kids and ask them to do it. There are programs out there where they're starting to put this into practice in an institutionalized way, in a positive institutionalized way. Like a lot of schools now have peer mediation programs. That's kind of a step in that direction. And there's some schools taking that, you know, even further. There's a group in town that does something called Courageous Conversations in the 4J school system here, where it's proactive. They don't wait until there's a problem. They get the kids get together and they talk about race issues and in a vulnerable way, try to understand each other. And I think that kind of work, you know, is going to do more to prevent violence in society than what we do about guns. You know, not that I'm opposed, you know, to stronger gun regulation. I'd support some of that. But the main problem is our social.
It's true. It is really. But even the gun problem, it's not, it's just the whole idea that you can fix things with violence. It's really, but again, it's the adults who have to lead the way to treat each other with compassion. Like, this is why on this radio show, I'm really picky about name calling and saying names. Like, I call him Traitor Trump because I think he's a traitor, but I don't like people that call him like an orange Cheeto, for example. Like, I think that that is not something that is effective, and I think it's demeaning, and I don't think we need to talk about people's appearance or how they look or any of that stuff. We really have to decide who people are based on what they do, not even what they say, but really what they do. And what they say is often an indication, but I think it's super important that we end up in a place where we are teaching each other compassion and constantly renewing our commitment to compassion with each other. Because it's not an easy task when people are not, when they're super horrible, you know, it's a constant renewal.
My biggest challenge is with myself, even, you know, stay compassionate, you know, rather than beat myself up.
Oh, yeah.
When I fall short on some of these things, oh, John, you're not being compassionate enough. Ah, John, that's just making it even worse.
Yeah, well, I think we're kind of trained to beat ourselves up. I think that's kind of the underlying message. And that's the thing that's part of the resistance, is like not letting the internal censor rule our lives, because that's just the programming, the negative program. So we get to refeed ourselves positive programming so we can get better results. And in that vein, I am an optimist. I mean, I think we have a grim situation. I think our responsibility is to actually admit where we're at, sort of face it, and refocus our science so that we can figure out a way to not have so many people have miserable lives till the very end. And, you know, I mean, I think we've got a big, heavy task in front of us.
Yeah. A domination society can only last as long as we continue to keep ourselves and each other down. If we're able to release the power of love in ourselves and with each other, we will sweep this thing aside, you know, and move to a new thing. I just want to mention briefly, there's a modern poor people's campaign getting launched right now. Go look it up, find it in your state, that's calling exactly as Martin Luther King did, you know, shortly before he was assassinated, for a moral revival in this country. And I think this is exactly what he was talking about, a revolution of compassion and love with each other, not only to support each other, but to be able to come together with enough power and with the right attitude to change this system with the least, you know, damage to everybody in the transition.
Those are beautiful words to end on. We have about 30 seconds. You've been listening with to John Abbey, Lonnie Clark, and Jerome Hebert. Thanks, John, for joining us. I hope you will come back. I really appreciate your thought and thinking. So send me the link to, you sent me a link to, can you tell me how to find the Martin Luther King thing? Give me some information on that so we can link people to that.
Yes.
I would suggest everybody put your courage feet on, take some action. Thanks, John. Thanks, Jerome.
Thank you.